This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rathke. You're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, usually 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where at KABF 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power is located, or the east side of New Orleans, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available to the show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Gary Crane, who is a man of many talents, investigative journalist. He's been involved in a startup. He's a PhD psychologist and a political activist, and that's what we're going to be talking to Gary about today. Welcome to Wade's World, Gary.
Hi, thanks a lot, Wade, for having me.
Gary, recently I've gotten a couple of emails from you and a conversation, and it's right in time with a lot of discussion that's going on about the recent presidential election. Obviously, there is now continuing confusion, even though President-elect Trump is moving forward. Hillary Clinton seems to have won the popular vote by more than 2 million votes, but her supporters in some cases are calling for recounts in some of the battleground states, and you have some thoughts about what should be done here.
Yeah, I think that the audit the vote movement is really catching on big time, and Jill Stein just raised, I think she's now up to more than $3 million, and she raised it in I believe, less than a day to enable her to audit the vote in Wisconsin and I think two other states, and she's still giving more money, so hopefully she'll be able to audit the vote in several states.
And Jill Stein was the Green Party candidate for president, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, and she has legal standing, so that's why she's able to do this. But what's most startling to me is Greg Palast, who's one of the best investigative journalists in the country, recently has the proof that in three states, Michigan, North Carolina, and Arizona, the method is called cross-check. It's the method that was used to steal the election in Florida, was again used to prevent 1.1 million black and brown voters this time from voting in those three states, which would have easily given her the margin of victory, a strong margin of victory. So those electoral votes really belong to her, and we suspect that we're going to find more of such illegal moves on the part of the GOP in these other states. So
those votes already would have been dropped. Those potential legitimate voters already would have been dropped before the November election,
right,
wouldn't they?
Yeah, I should explain how cross-check works. And this was probably the most powerful method used in Florida in 2000 to steal the vote for Bush. The way it works is that since black and brown people tend to have a lot of the same common names, you know, Bob Jones, Bob Johnson, Bill James, Bill Brown, Mike Hernandez, Steve Medeiros, mm-hmm. and so forth, these common names, it's very easy to create a huge list of all the felons with the same first and last name and just leave out the middle name and then send those to their county registrars saying, don't let these people vote, they're felons. And that's the method that was used yet again. And
well, I think interstate cross-check didn't start until 2005, correct?
No, that was used in to cage out 75,000 eligible, pretty much black voters in Florida. And you recall that Bush only won by, quote, 500 votes. I mean, we don't really know if the recount was stopped by the Brooks Brothers revolt. But anyway, According to Palace, there were at least 75,000 voters that were not allowed to vote that were eligible voters in Florida using this the same method.
Well, it may have been a similar method, but cross-check what I think Palace's point on this particular election and why more than a million people may have been disenfranchised is that 30 states are now using cross-check beginning in 2005 out of Kansas.
Yeah.
Was first, you know, sort of neighbors, but under the aggressive, you know, promulgation of this program by the, you know, infamous Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State there, it's now grown in the last 3 years to be 30 different states doing this, ostensibly to see if people are voting in more than one state. That was supposedly the purpose of it and why many of the states signed up. And then what really happened is it's thrown, as Gary Crane is now telling us, it threw a lot of people off the ballot. Now, but these challenges on the audits are based on the elections being close in several states and potentially asking for a recount. That's what former candidate Stein is trying to get, correct?
Right. I was talking to the director of Protect Our Elections just two nights ago, and he was telling me that they're already finding things like, for example, in Wisconsin, they found that 1,500 votes for Trump were counted twice. And in Michigan, he only won by, I believe, 17,000 votes, just by a hair. And some of these other margins are also very, very thin, like in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be very interesting to find out what they find out. But the point I'm leading up to is that there's now ample evidence that the election was stolen. And I believe auditing the vote, while it's incredibly important and necessary, is simply not going to be enough to prevent a Trump presidency, you know, in a legal presidency, the third, basically, coup d'etat we've had in this country. And we need to basically do what Ukraine did when they discovered this happened to their election in November 2004, which is they had a general strike, mass disruption, and it caused a re-election. And ironically, the man that masterminded the stealing of the Ukrainian election is Paul Manafort, who was Trump's first campaign, I believe first or second campaign manager. And for all we know, I mean, there's no proof of this yet, but he probably stayed in the background guiding the stealing of this election.
And that's some pretty, you know, broad speculation, isn't it, Gary? Why do you think that Secretary of State Clinton is not part of these challenges on the vote yet, or at all?
I know. It's a very good question. I have no idea.
Because, you know, reports are, by some of the pundits and political reporters and whatnot, is that she and her people have looked at it and don't believe, even if there was a recount, that it would be sufficient to overturn those votes in those states, and essentially thinks it's sort of a waste of time and money. But obviously, from what you're saying, Stein must not believe that if she's raised $3 million.
Right. She doesn't believe it. I don't believe it. Greg Palast has already proven that it was stolen. So I think it's time that the American people stop being sheeple and stand up against the, you know, a third now stolen election in just 16 years. And have a general strike, because that's the only thing that's ever really proven as an option to really work in these kinds of examples. And what the other thing that really encouraged me about, to make me realize this is not some quixotic, fanciful idea, is the work of Erica Chenoweth, who's a sociologist, political scientist. She was a Harvard fellow. She has incredible credentials. And she and another woman wrote a rather definitive book on it called Why Mass Resistance Works. And she gives two very compelling TED Talks, one compelling TED Talk and then a much longer talk. You can Google her name, Chenoweth, C-H-E-N-O-W-E-T-H. And that's what encouraged me. And she's discovered, studying the use of general strikes and mass resistance since 1900 up through the Ukrainian Revolution, the Orange Revolution, that if you get about 4% of the public actively engaged, you have an 80 to 90% chance of success. And these forms of resistance are more than twice as effective as violent resistance, which usually ends up leading to civil wars and this kind of situation you see in Syria.
And that was the main thesis of her research, wasn't it? The comparison between violent and nonviolent protests. She's a sociologist.
Right.
She's not an organizer. So, I mean, she's just looking at what's happened in a number of countries. That doesn't necessarily make her much of an expert on what it would take to change something like an election in the U.S., does it, Gary?
No, but that's where I think Gene Sharp's work comes in, because he's written a very important book called From Dictatorship to Democracy, and his techniques, his organizing techniques, have proven incredibly effective in many different situations around the world.
Well, I mean, Gene Sharp's work, once again, focuses on the varied and robust repertoire of nonviolent tactics.
Right.
Not necessarily the kind of a problem that you have that we face right now, which is an election that some people didn't support, but seems to have ended up with Donald Trump as our next president and Hillary Clinton as our defeated candidate. And let's talk more about why you call this election stolen, Gary, because what we're talking about in terms of interstate cross-check is people who were disqualified before the vote. Normally, when people think about a vote being stolen, they're thinking about ballot boxes being turned over or fake votes being cast or something along those lines. Is that what you're saying that happened here in some of these states, or is it just people who were disenfranchised? Because that was quite a concerted campaign over the last number of years to disenfranchise millions of people.
Right. Well, I'm focusing primarily on Greg Powell's work about the disenfranchisement and preventing these people. But we may discover, as I mentioned before, that there were other methods used, like double counting, and there's something called fraction magic that Beverly Harris at Black Box Voting has, in fact, discovered. It's actually in the software of quite a lot of these machines. That, and the way fraction magic works is that when people vote from precincts that the machine has already been programmed to know are heavily Democratic, their votes end up counting as a half a vote, and then people voting from heavily Republican districts, their votes are counted as two votes or one and a half votes. And I'm not an expert at all on fraction magic, but I strongly suggest people Google that phrase and read about what they're discovering at Black Box Voting. And by the way, Greg Palast, his site is Greg, GREGPALAST.com.
Gotcha.
PLAST.com.
We're talking to Gary Crane today. He's a longtime political activist and has been trying to promote a strategy to overturn the last election and see if it's possible to get a new vote. Gary, what got you going in this direction?
Well, I just think there's nothing wise, smart, there's nothing honorable in allowing a, quote, smooth transition to fascism and a smooth transition to basically saying goodbye to our planet as we know it, to letting our probably last window of opportunity to save nature as we know it to just be kicked under the bus. And because most of the climate scientists, ocean scientists, have pretty much concluded that, to quote Sylvia Earle, these next 8 years will be the most important 8 years in the next 8,000 years. And there's many scientists that believe that these next 4 years, if we don't pretty much make a very complete change to wind and solar, we may be cooked, literally as well as figuratively.
Was climate change, in your view, a central or important issue in this last election?
I think that's the most compelling issue. I mean,
did Secretary of State Clinton make that case? I mean,
Well, I think the difference, the world of difference between Clinton and Trump on this is Trump doesn't believe in climate change. He's a climate denier. The people that he wants to put in charge of the interior are climate deniers. He wants to basically abolish the EPA, whereas Clinton has proved that she's quite swayable on this. Bill McKibben, the head of 350, who was on the platform committee, said that, you know, when enough pressure and argument was put, her people pretty much cave in on most of the things that they wanted, you know, and so she's at least swayable.
President-elect Trump has said that he's open. Said it, you know, 7 or 8 times. He's open to hearing more about climate change. So maybe he's swayable, too. But there's a report in today's New York Times that argued that issues, if you looked at the coverage and the way the campaign was managed, character was the big hit, not any particular issue, including the economy. So in some ways, what may have happened is any argument about climate change was just sort of pushed to closer to the bottom of the list. I'm not sure how much that was driving the vote, Gary.
Oh, no. I don't believe that that's relevant to why either candidate lost, why she lost or why he won. But I do think that that's, for me personally, and I think for a lot of people, that's the most compelling reason why we need to have a fair election, a new election. And aside from the fact that I believe it was illegally obtained. And I just think that there's so much at stake in terms of, I mean, you're right. The question about the climate change environment was not even asked in any of the debates. It's an outrage.
Well, a lot of questions weren't asked. You know, what programs people had, either candidate had for poor people. You know, what was
right.
really going on.
Yeah,
I mean, this was one of those very unusual. So how is this nothing more but a bunch of sore loser talk? There was an election. It looked like Clinton was going to win. She lost. Incredibly enough for many people, Donald Trump won. And seems like the consensus throughout much of the public is that that's what's happening, that's what it's going to be, and it's 4 years of Donald Trump. So why are you not talking about 4 years from now or what needs to be done over the next 4 years? Why do you really believe there's one chance in a million that anything could turn this around?
Okay. Well, there's two or three reasons. Number one, I've already said the first one, is that he illegally, quote, won the election. It was not a fair election. It was a stolen election. Number two, I said that there's so much at stake. These next 4 years could be our last chance to actually save nature as we know it. Number three, Erica Chenoweth's work shows that, in fact, a general strike is a doable, winnable strategy. Because only 3 to 4% of the public really needs to be actively involved to achieve an 80-90% chance of success, and I think probably the most compelling reason, just in terms of common sense, is that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We can spend the next four, and with the Supreme Court, we're likely to have the next umpteen years pushing a huge boulder up a hill, and have probably a 3% chance of moving this government, which is now all three branches, which are controlled by a far right wing, or we can have an 80-90% chance of success by having a general strike and mass disruption and having a new election.
Well, let's just suspend disbelief for a second and talk about what it's like to organize any strike, much less a general strike. Now, in this election, many people are arguing based on the data, the polls, the exit, and everything else, that part of what happened is that working class voters supported Donald Trump, who won the election. And it would have to be workers, I would assume, who are involved in this general strike, or what you're thinking there?
Well, yeah, it would have to be workers. But, I mean, ironically, we're so dependent now on technology that, frankly, I don't, you know this probably way better than me, but a few thousand chief engineers in charge of databases for the banking system alone could probably shut down the country if they were involved. So I'm not even sure we need, 10 million Americans having a general strike. But certainly that's what I'd like to see. In some ways, it would be kind of counterproductive to have a few thousand database engineers shutting down the country.
Well, I mean, that sounds like what we could have gotten from the allegedly, Russian-based hackers.
Right.
Didn't happen, as near as people can tell, that the election system, although vulnerable, was not hacked from at least reports that exist thus far. And there's nothing so far that any of us know. I know you've spent time in California as well, Gary, but there's nothing particularly about tech engineers, software engineers, that indicates that they would have much politics at all, one way or another, much less the ability for a thousand of them to come together and somehow, monkey wrench the entire U.S. economy.
Right. Well, they tend to be a libertarian in terms of their own politics. I think it generally is accepted that the allegedly Russian hacking that went to WikiLeaks, hacking the DNC, was one very important factor that technique that Russia used to significantly further lower Hillary's credibility. So I think that Russia did play an important role in getting the election to Trump, and that's pretty generally conceived, except that Axelrod brings that point himself. But you're right, Axelrod also, I think, who was Obama's campaign manager, said that ultimately the product was not a strong product.
Well, and that's a problem. We're talking to Gary Crane, who's a political activist and involved in technology and psychology and a number of other things for a number of years. Gary, this sounds like, are you talking to a lot of people? I mean, is this part of the energy of some progressives who are dissatisfied with Trump, that they seem to, are there others who believe there's any chance of overturning an election and sort of having a reset or a redo? And if so, to the degree the argument that seems to be made is that some voters were illegitimately cast out before the election, I'm not sure how they would all of a sudden be legitimately able to vote or what guarantee we'd have that they would vote. It seems like you've got a pretty uphill climb here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this should be a very difficult thing to do. But what I'm saying is that what's the alternative? I think the alternative is spending 4 years, 8 years, 12 years of a similar amount of effort and probably getting nowhere because you're fighting against not only the Congress being Republican, but with the Trump presidency, the executive and the Supreme Court being far right wing, or at least the three branches of government. So,
but wouldn't you and Professor Chenoweth and others argue that perhaps it's time to try to organize a movement on the progressive side, if you will, to more clearly advance issues? I mean, you're concerned about climate. Certainly I'm concerned about what happens to low and moderate income people. Is there potential traction at looking at, I mean, part of the base that ended up electing President-elect Trump is the base that normally would be part of the core support for a progressive movement. Unions, working class voters. Why aren't we doing the job of organizing? That seems to be something that could take a lot of time over the next 4 years.
Yeah, well, I think brand new Congress and Nader's latest strategy are two excellent ways that we have a chance of doing that. Brandnewcongress.org is planning on basically using the Bernie machine, the fundraising machine, to raise the kind of monies that are needed to elect a majority House and Senate that basically is in tune with Bernie's platform. which would be great if it works. And I certainly hope to plan to support that as much as possible. I'm always mentioning brandnewcongress.org. And then Nader's new book, and you probably, I think it's called Regaining Power or Going It. Do you remember the name?
I don't.
Okay, well, anyway, he's basically saying that if simply 1,000 people in every congressional district would organize an entity to put pressure on their local representatives, and it could be 1,000 people that basically share the same common things that both right and left agree upon that he talks about in his book Unstoppable, for example, stopping NSA spying and very likely what we need to get rid of the fossil fuel system and create 10 million jobs based on wind and solar, a lot of these common areas, we can end up with a Congress possibly in 2 years from now that could be, you know, do what we need to do.
Well, recently a federal judge overturned a redistricting effort based solely on the fact that it was, usually it's on voting rights, but this time it was on partisanship. Is that part of what this new Congress hopes, is that some of the more directly partisan efforts to redistrict might be overturned?
Yeah, well, I know that's what, of course, that's what brand new Congress would hope to do. I don't know if that's, that would seem to be an arguable area that would that you'd find a coalition around, a right-left coalition. But, I mean, if we get a brand new Congress in time for the 2020 census, then that's hopefully that the debacle of gerrymandering can finally come to an end.
Well, there's a whole lot of things on the to-do list, isn't there?
Yes.
So what would you rate the chances of overturning the election? It must be one in a million, or do you think it's better than that?
Oh, no, I think it's way better than that, but I don't really know. I just know that there's nothing, as I said, honorable, wise, or smart in accepting a smooth transition to a fascist system, that you have all three brands. I think we have to do everything we can to stop it. I mean, what are you going to say if the planet starts falling apart in a few years when people say, well, what did you do to stop it? And I don't mean you personally, but if all you can say is, well, I voted for Bernie or I voted for Hillary, I don't think that's enough. We really have an obligation to Mother Nature, to the planet, not to mention poor people, working people, immigrants, to do everything we can to stop yet a third illegally obtained election, a third coup d'etat. And I think Erica's work, Erica Chenoweth's work, shows that this is doable.
In theory.
In theory. Well, no.
I mean, the practical organizing is, you know, the obstacles to practically organizing this kind of thing are phenomenal. I mean,
yes,
yeah, I mean, it's a big world, and some things have happened in other countries for various indigenous and other reasons that it's hard to translate into a United States context.
Okay. Let me give you two things that I think will start persuading people that this is doable, in addition to Chenoweth's work. And she looks at more than 60 struggles that to basically topple dictators. We're not even talking about toppling a dictator. We're talking about preventing a right-wing fascist from getting office, which I think should be simpler to do than toppling one. But number one is that in 1963, six ordinary women who were not trained organizers got together in their living room and decided that it was outrageous. They shared their fears, they shared their anger, and decided that what was happening with nuclear testing and strontium 90 showing up in babies' teeth was outrageous. And less than 70 days later, they had hundreds of thousands of women in major cities blocking traffic, totally disrupting business as usual. And that was the kind of basic pressure that finally convinced John F. Kennedy to unilaterally declare a moratorium on testing, which led to everybody, all the other nuclear testing powers, to stop nuclear testing as well. So, and they did not have the internet, they did not have email, they had mimeograph machines. So if they can do that with what they were dealing with, that's one reason why I think this is possible. And you know more than me about how general strikes, you know, have worked in the past in other countries. And we have a lot more going for us now. It's about with Twitter and with Facebook and with the Internet and with email. And then the second, the third thing that makes me confident this could happen is an app that I'm working on. And if there's any coders listening, we definitely urgently need programmers, and we also need social media people to help us. But this is an app that I call Kickstarter Meets Movement Organizing. And the assumption behind this app is that most people will not get involved in direct action or even canvassing unless they feel there's enough other people involved doing this that gives you the kind of safety in numbers and logistically the confidence that you're going to have enough pressure on decision makers to actually win. So let's say there is on this app a call to action to have a general strike, and the math is laid out that if we have X million people spread out in these different cities willing to stop business as usual and have a general strike, we can win if we can keep it up for X number of days or X number of weeks. Are you willing to join? Move the slider bar to the numbers of people in your city that if they join, you will join too. And it becomes, therefore, it removes the main cognitive or psychological barrier to people getting involved, which is, well, are there enough other people willing to get involved? That's why if you know how Kickstarter works, it's the same idea. If here's, somebody wants to make a movie, it's going to cost $1 million. Will you give us $50 to help? Your $50, your credit card is not charged until enough other people have come up with a total of $1 million.
Gary, thank you for being on Wade's World. There's a lot of creativity now in the wake of the recent election, and Gary has given us his case for what needs to be done. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams saying, things you've never seen and will never forget. We say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio, until next week when we're going to talk about the explosion of contract for deed sales in low-income families. And Jack McNamara, who had the Contract Buyers League in the 1950s in Chicago, is going to be our guest. This is Wade Rathke for Wade's World. Thank you.